to get hold of the idea of an internal condition governing your external circumstances, and the idea of the planets having effects on external circumstances as internal to the universe, how the one was working inside the other all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't quite get it very clear.
So. I suppose we start off by drawing a large circle to represent the whole universe. This is Anton's proof of the existence of God. Imagine a circle in which you can imagine no larger, and that circle is God. Outside that is a Godhead, but that particular circle is God. If you can imagine a larger one than this, well then the first one isn't God, but the other one is. Now, we know today, not theoretically but practically, that matter is force behaving in a certain way. So the conservation of matter and energy of the early 19th century has given way to the conservation of mass energy, not matter. Matter is matura. I remember the M implies a closure. Matura is a rotation of primary power. So this must be conceived as a dynamic in swing of power, and everything inside it is going round. Now you can see a very peculiar thing about this, because although there is only one circle and the one power, if we put a rod on it to measure it, we immediately find that there are different speeds in the one being. Supposing we imagine that this is a cardboard circle, and we put a peg in the middle of it and spin it, so that the whole circle of cardboard is one, and therefore it cannot be moving at different velocities, because there's only one, and the parts of it are not changing place relative to each other. But if we put a rod across it and measure it by marking on the disc a particular marker, and when it goes round we call it a half circle when it gets to there, and when it comes back again to here we call it a full circle, we see a very peculiar thing, because relative to this rod, the size of this perimeter is greater than another one inside, and another, and so on. So if we mark this in terms of units, we'll take 12 to begin with. We could call those like the hours on a clock. If we imagine this is a clock face made in cardboard, and instead of the fingers rotating, we arrange a drive whereby the clock face rotates, we will see, if we measure the distance across there, we'll say, for instance, in this case, we'll pretend it's 2 inches here. Well, if we draw that to the centre, that one must be less than 2 inches. We'll say that it's 3/4, and there it's a half, and so on here, quarter. Now, we can see that as the whole thing is fixed and is one, if it turns, then relative to this rod, the distance traversed by the perimeter is greater there than this distance, greater than that, and so on. So it appears then that the nearer we go to the centre, the slower it is going, although it is really only one, and therefore relative to itself and its internal relations, the whole thing is moving at the same speed. Yet relative to an external marker, like this imaginary rod, then there are different speeds. So we could say that the perimeter of the universe is travelling at a very, very great speed, but the centre of it is not travelling at all. Now if we imagine that that is the Earth, now here's the equator, there's the pole, and there's another one below, the speed of the Earth's rotation at the equator is about 18 miles per second. And at the poles, it's nil, although the Earth is one. so that if we put a marker outside, an imaginary marker like the moon, and imagine for a moment we can fix it, then if we mark on here, say, Honolulu or something, and let it spin round, marked against the moon, it will be doing 18 miles per second, and at the pole, nil. So if we go along the different latitudes there, we will find different apparent speeds. And this is one of the causes of the difference of metabolism, the chemistry in the blood, in different peoples. Equatorial peoples run a faster rate of metabolism than polar peoples. And that diagram of the Earth is exactly the same as the diagram for the universal sphere. Now, remember that matter is only force behaving in a certain way, namely rotating. Because we have represented this universe as a rotation, we say that when we are considering force rotating, we are talking about the material universe. But that material universe is simply the universe as rotating. Outside here, we call it not material because it doesn't rotate. And in the process of rotating, we get this relative decrease as we go towards the center. So that for ourselves as Earth beings, it appears to us that the Earth is still, because we are moving with it at the same velocity that it moves at whatever latitude we live at. So if we consider the whole universal sphere as a rotation of power, we can see that there are different velocities inside here, so that it's very important at what point within the universe you are born, because all the velocities or forces in the universe are relative to your relation to the perimeter and the center. So we could say the nearer to the center you are, the more still you are, and the nearer to the perimeter, the more in motion you are. We can describe the same diagram and let it represent, if you like, one living organism, a single cell, an egg, an amoeba without any pseudopodia sticking out. We can see that the perimeter of it must be apparently moving more quickly than the internal. And if we remember also that it would be the point stimulated from outside, we can see that the whole of your external part, your skin surfaces, your eyes, your ears, nose, etc., your five sense organs, are the ones that are going to be disturbed from outside. And that the more you can internalize your attention, the more you are able to control yourself. Control, incidentally, means count the roles, and the roles referred to are the roles of your substantial form, which is the same thing as your memory, the roles of the memory. Remember, if a force goes in your organism and goes out again without rotating, it is no memory, it is an immediate reaction. But if it goes in and rotates, it makes a memory for the duration of the rotation. That's one of the roles you've got to count. And inside you may have a lot of roles like this. And altogether they constitute your memory. We'll come back to those later on, because from this diagram we can prove that what you think is yourself is merely formal, and the egoic center, the ahankara of the yogis, is purely mechanical and can do nothing whatever except react to stimuli. So we'll come back to that diagram later. Meanwhile, we have to remind ourselves of this sphere, which as rotating is called matter, is really a force system. And therefore, it is tremendously important at what point you come to be. Supposing we remember that every being is a rotation, that soul itself is solo, it is force made solo. The U in soul simply means power, drive. So S-O-L, soul, the name of the sun, because there's only one of it in this system, and in any other system there is one. Solo means one, the sun, soul, and solo with power is soul. A cell is so called because it contains, within a rotation, a certain amount of work, formal work. A self implies there is consciousness in it. The F at the end of self means spirit, and spirit is consciousness. So supposing we imagine this is the big universal circle, and inside it we have the star system, which we'll mark off with stars. And those stars are, if you like, the outermost band of formal influences. And they are radiating all the time. And if you look at them, you find that they're all spinning structures. You see in the case of the spiral nebulae that there is evidence photographically that they are centres of vortical activity, spin centres. So if we have two stars, one there and one there, and they're both spinning into centres like this, they must be exhausting the space between. If we say there's the star band, we'll write the word star and see what it means. Because star is a spirit, ta-rota. So a star is a rotation of force. And if we come inside here, we find another one, a subsidiary one, the solar system. We'll mark that as a little star. And going around that, the planetary system, of which one is the Earth. Now we have a series of movements here. From the perimeter there to the centre, we have a gradation, the degrees of movement. We are in one system, and therefore we are already conditioned. Before we are born, we are conditioned as forms within our ancestors. In the Bible, you notice it said in one place, how did you know him? I knew him when he was in Abraham's loins. Which is a statement that the seed in a man is a vortical spin center, and that intelligence is screwing itself in and compacting itself to make one of those bearers of form, bearers of hereditament, because hereditament is only a form of power. So, providing we conceive this universe as one whole wheel of power, and we see the relative velocities according to the distance from the perimeter to the centre, we can understand why it is that only at certain points in the universe is it possible to learn to balance. There are places in the universe where no type of balance can be gained because the velocity is too great. There are others where it cannot be gained because everything is too passive, it can't move towards it. And only in between the two extremes is it possible to make such a balance of forces that a free being may come to exist. Now if we take the word Earth, remember that hear, O Israel, is the first commandment. There's the ear. The ear has in it a little sounding board. And in exactly the same way, the Earth is a sounding board for various forces which are echoing backwards and forwards from the centre to the perimeter and back again, and they're swinging over in figures of eight all the way around. And at the intersection points of those is this solar system with the Earth travelling round it. Now, you know, once upon a time it was taught that the Earth was the centre of the universe, and afterwards it was said that this wasn't true because the Earth is moving. And you know that Einstein's demonstrations that motion is relative have made it possible to see what might have been meant by the ancients when they said that the Earth was the centre of the universe. If you take the H off the end of Earth and put it at the other end, it makes a heart, which is the centre of the thing. If you leave the other H, it makes hearth, which is the centre of the home. And the hirath is the power law. And this is the power law which we are concerned with, this sphere as force rotating. The Earth actually has, within the solar system, the central orbit, not in terms of distance from the Sun to the outer band of Pluto, but in terms of the mass of the solar system and the resonances that are cutting across it from the Sun to the outer limit of the solar system and back again. And at that intersection point, that nodal point of that eight wave, if you like, there's an orbit. round which the sun is travelling and the earth is travelling round it in this manner. And thus, upon the earth, there is a possibility of beings having the right kind of speed of presentation of form. That is to say, the thinking process can be controlled, and it is therefore an educational centre within the universe itself. And providing we remember that we're dealing with forces, we can easily understand how there are these relative differences from the perimeter to the centre of the whole being. Remember, when we're talking about being, we're talking about circumscription. There is no being other than rotation of force. If the force stops rotating, it is no longer called being, because this letter B, the beta, means a house, a dwelling, a circumscribed zone. While we're on this subject, we can consider very carefully a very important fact. The fact that at the lowest level of consciousness for a human being, ideas and feelings are apparently distinct. That is, you can think without feeling. You can say 2 and 2 is 4. And while you are doing so, you don't particularly feel emotionally disturbed about it. But at the top level, if you say 2 and 2 are 4, then you are also feeling something about it, necessarily. And we will now see why. We said that the word idea was a Greek word for the Latin form, the Saxon shape. And you can see, if you look at it, id, which became the Latin it, air, which is the same air in earth, and it means spiritual activity dividing. So the idea of spirit as dividing itself, which involves a half rotation, the D, and there's the other half, that's 2 D's back to back. Idea is that which we can use to analyze the absolute. We analyze it, that is to say, we loose the motions in it in order to consider them. And every idea is a motion of force. So that if we can define means set the limits of the application of a word, we have defined a type of motion, a velocity, and a direction. If we take a definite amount of force plus a direction, we call it a vector. And if we conceive the universe in terms of vectors, we are considering it as forces moving in definite directions, in which case we could conceive the whole universe as a vector system. So an idea is necessarily circumscribed, and any circumscription whatever is legitimately called an idea. Now, in philosophy, it is very important to understand that if we're dealing with Platonic philosophy, when Plato uses this word, idea, he means a form in the universal. He would deny that it was a legitimate use of the word idea to say that you have an idea of a particular thing you have seen with your senses, with your eye, or with your ear, and so on. You cannot have an idea, he says, except of universal form. And he's talking about this fact that all ideas are circumscriptions, and there is one big circumscription, which is the Logos, which word was borrowed by the early Christians from Platonic sources. The Stoics called the universe itself Logos as well. Plato uses the same idea and calls it the demiurge, the half-worker, because outside it is that which does not rotate. So if this is called God by some people, it is by those people who prefer to be free. And if this is called God, and only this, within the circle, it is called God by those people who want security. But if those beings exist who don't care whether they are secure or insecure, they can use the word God, if they wish, for both or neither. They can say God is whatever we choose to will, because the object of the will is the good, and God is good. Therefore, that is your God towards which you will. Where the treasure is, there is the heart also, is a statement. That is your God to which you will. That towards which you exert your force to attain. So, if we call this a God, inside here, in Christians, we call this the Godhead, that which is before and without, outside the God. But it also goes underneath, the white paper is going underneath all this drawing, and therefore we say that the Godhead is immanent in God. And for all ordinary purposes of worship, we are concerned with the consideration of this God, simply because we live and move and have our being inside it, and are already conditioned by it, and we cannot get out of this God into that one without first of all learning how to control the motions inside it, which are inside our own being. It is possible for us, if we wish to, and we learn a certain amount of self-control, to travel from where we are outwards more and more towards the perimeter of the universe. And if we go right to the limit of it, and we have got sufficient integration, we could force our way out and become a little universe on our own, outside it. That would be called, from the point of view of the God inside, a devil had been spewed out into the outer darkness. From our own point of view, it might be that we want to experiment and make a universe outside. But if we conform and move towards this center more and more, we are then said to be worshipping this God. And we are said to be followers of this one God, and he will not spew us out of the mouth into the outer darkness. Because quite obviously, if we are moving towards the perimeter, and we are a substantial modification of the whole force of that being, then we cannot be disobeying its function. We must become more and more passive to the centre, because we said that the amount of action going on around that is relatively greater than that going on in the centre. So if we begin to become less law-breaking and more law-abiding in the universal sense, we apparently cut down the motion on the outside and move towards the centre and become obedient to that God. But there are some beings who do not like to do that. In the Bible they're called goats and devils and so on. They say we don't want to do that, we want to go the other way and eventually get thrown out and make little universes of our own. And that is a matter for individual choice. Fundamentally, you can see that if a being comes into existence here, remember existence is existere, which means out of a sixfold wheel. Simply, if something starts rotating there, that is a soul, because it is rotating. If it is born on the perimeter, it will like it, and the idea of moving that way will seem to it to be wrong, because it would seem to be denying its own activity. But if, on the other hand, it came to be near the centre, then it would appear to it to be a great degeneration to have to move away from the centre. You remember Emanuel Swedenborg had some visions in which he went to heaven, as he conceived it ought to be, and he saw Jesus Christ in the middle, and a series of concentric circles, and the farther away you went from the middle, the darker it was, and right on the perimeter here were a lot of ministers of the gospel arguing about heresies and things. And Swedenborg was allowed to go right to the inner circle, because he was a very good man. But he was very, very startled to find that when he went into the outer circles to convert these various sectarians, that they were not converted and didn't like his arguments. And you may remember that William Blake on one occasion was visited by an angel who showed him that he was worshipping what in effect was a horrible pit of filth. Whereupon William Blake, undismayed, took the angel to the angel's heaven and showed him also something very, very horrible. Whereupon the angel said, "You are imposing on me." To which Blake replied, "We are imposing on each other." Because fundamentally, good, if you see the goo, it doesn't matter how you spell it, goo is still goo. The gullet inside you is a little ghoul. Ghoul is the same as a will of appetite, prime drive. So the gullital nature in you is really the center of appetite. The actual physical tissue, with the spontaneous movements that are going on in that gullital worm, it's the old worm of the Bible, the old serpent, the movements in it are all drawing in to grab what they can, and that is the ghoul. Now, if we put D in there, that's as far as it goes. When it says in the Bible that God said, let there be so-and-so, and then he saw it was good, this is the same God. As a matter of fact, in Manx, it's the ghoul was the G, and the G was the ghoul. It's the same way they say that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God. Ghoul and G are the same fellow. This ghoul is the primary go. You've got what you call get up and go. Prime drive. And it goes as far as it wishes to, and then stops. And then it utters, I have gone far enough, or good. If you really make, you can pronounce it properly and say good. So, the good resides in the belly zone. We'll put G for good down there, and it's G for gamma, or gammon, whichever you prefer. Good there, beauty there, and truth in your head. The good, the beautiful, and the true. We put the true in the head because it relates to form. The good in the belly because it relates to how far your gullible appetite goes. And between the two, in the conflict, in the opposition of form, which is truth, and urge, or prime drive, which is restrained by form, between the two, as form presses down and will or gullet presses up, there arises a resolution of form and will, which when perfectly balanced we call beautiful. Notice in the word beauty, I think we did this one before, we might as well write it in French, it will save a letter on you. There is water in French, it's a French derived word. In the middle is the O, the water. And beauty is this uninterrupted motion. The sensation you get when you see a well-composed painting or listen to a well-composed piece of music is that somehow this is inevitable, that is a flow. And this is the O in the beauté. So beauty implies the sensation arising from the uninterrupted fulfillment of your will. Now, we revert to this idea, concept, it is a rotation. And we say that the whole universe is a big idea, the Logos. But inside it, there are other rotations like this, which determine the orbits of stars, the orbits of the solar system, the orbits of planets, screwing themselves round. You can see the whole thing, literally, is full of tiny rotations. And if we drill these rotations right down to the tiniest one we can, that is an ultimate particle which science will try to discover. When it's getting near to the electron, it's getting near to it, but the electron is not it. It's considerably finer, more subtle than that. So, we have a system here of rotations, and idea implies this rotation, and as far as a rotation goes, that is an idea. But a rotation is an actual motion of force, which is fundamentally spirit, self-mobilized, which at the point of initiation we call will, and therefore we could say that the universe is a function of will. If we say a function of divine will, divine is this div root, which is the dio in the Latin, it's div in Sanskrit, it's the dio in Jupiter, God the Father. And read this way, videre, to see. God is he who sees what he is doing. If a man knows what he's doing, can see what he's doing, execute his purposes, we say he is divine, and we talk about the divine. This ein, incidentally, is a form of the word one. In German, they've anagrammed it a little, turn it round, E-I-N, ein. In the Hebrew, we would spell it in English with an A-Y-I-N, ayin. And in Egyptian, it is quite simply a drawing of a human eye. So the idea of unity is the same thing as the idea of a self, an ego. So if you get unity, then you are becoming one person. But if you do not get unity, then you are not one person, but many. You're a schizophrenic. Christ said, the eye of the body is the light of the body. If thine eye be single, then the whole being is full of light. So that the unity
of your body depends on the unity of the eye, the observer, the watcher, and that watcher is fundamentally a force which at the point of initiation is called will, and therefore unity of will is the only way of getting light, which is understanding, which is wisdom, as a dome, a whizzing dome. An idea, therefore, is any rotation whatever, and we see that all these rotations are travelling all the time, and therefore we can see that any idea can pass into any other idea. Therefore translation is possible from one language to another, and synonyms exist, and so on. And antonyms are related very, very intimately, because when an idea is round there and has travelled round to there, it is that same one which has become its opposite on the other side. Because opposite means at the two ends of a diameter through the ob. So an idea then is a rotation of a force. The force is fundamentally will, and all these rotations take place in the field. Kshatriya is the Sanskrit for field. The warrior is called Kshatriya, he who affirms the struggle in the field of forces. This is a field of forces, and the rotations within the forces are centres to the field, so that whenever there is a rotation, you can call that a centre of the field. So we say that the centre of the universe is anywhere. That is, wherever there is a vortical spin, it is a centre. We then see that an idea is a very peculiar thing. It is force, intelligence, moving. It is not a static thing. Lots of very bad European commentators on Plato have suggested that his concept of the ideal world was a world of static form, and they have then wasted their time tilting at it, when he says quite definitely that an idea is an intelligent being persisting in being itself. In fact, you can't find any Greek philosopher of that period who does not believe that an idea is a piece of intelligence behaving in a certain way. If we go into Arabic mystical sources, we find spirits called jinn, and the control of the jinn, you know, the same as the jinn in the bottle in the Arabian Nights. Jinn is the word to judge. It's the din of the Hebrew, you know, the Hebrew place where they make sure that everything is kosher, is called Beit Din, the house of judgment. And this din means judge. It's the Oxford Don. The word Don is the same thing. Judge, the tribe of Dan. You can change the vowel about because the function is D-N, where D means analysis and N means continuous motion. So continuous motion analysing is the same thing as judge, the judge who goes along dividing. An idea, therefore, is an intelligent being moving along and witnessing itself. And this is why ideas are very, very hard to control, because they are not static. They are continuously developing themselves. Those ideas are having children, that is, derivative ideas. And each idea is the centre of a field of force, which, viewed from the point of view of initiation, is called a will. Therefore, any idea you have is evidence that you have also a will to that idea. So unless you get an idea big enough to comprehend other ideas, you haven't got a will big enough to comprehend all the derivative wills of your nature. And the whole problem of self-control is in the cell of your being to set up the role and count it so that you know what you've got. Until you know what you have on your rolls formally, you cannot have control. You can't count what you haven't got, and you can't count what you don't know about, even if you have got it. And it has to be realized that ideas are so intelligent, much more so than the average fellow is intelligent, because an idea knows when you are trying to control it, and it will deliberately become quiet, so that you don't know it is there. An idea within your own being can deliberately hide. It can also do another funny trick. It can persuade other ideas to obscure it. related ideas, it can send them up to consciousness and say, explain that I've given it up, I've reformed. So that your governing concept, which is your idea, nothing else, a governing concept, your idea of yourself as an improved being, which is only another idea, is deceived and duped by other ideas who say, if your governing concept to control us is allowed to succeed, we won't be able to enjoy ourselves. Therefore, in order to make quite sure that you do not get control of us, we are going to mess everything up. The other day, a little girl that was apparently enjoying going to school vomited tremendously all day long. When she was questioned, she said she liked school and so on. And she's, how old is she now? She's 8. She's been told about one or two things, and she knows that the mind has a lot hidden in it. I asked her whether she really wanted to go to school, and she said definitely she did. And she was telling the truth. I said, is there anything at school at all that you don't like? And she said, I don't like the voice of the woman in the next room who teaches. I said, does it distress you? And she said, I don't know whether it does or not, but I don't like it. So I said, well, will you think of it now, very, very carefully, and imagine that you're going to go in the same room with that woman and see what happens. And she closed her eyes and imagined it and probably vomited. So I then told her that she need not go into that room at all, and in fact, she could imagine that she wasn't going to school the next day. And I then said, do you feel sick? And she said, yes, I still feel sick. I said, hold this idea in your mind. Remember, this is a child of 8. Hold the idea in your mind that you're not going to go to school tomorrow and then try and be sick. Now, she held that idea very firmly with her eyes closed, and then she tried to be sick and she failed. And she said, why is that? So I told her, because when you formulate ideas in the mind, every idea is the center of a feeling. And these feelings are either I like it or I don't like it. And if they're I don't like it, they send messages down the nerves to the stomach, and they squeeze it and say to it, we don't like this situation. And the stomach responds by kicking out the food which would give it the energy to get into the situation it doesn't like. You see the internal logic there. That the stomach is breaking matter down to give you energy so that you can do something. So that if you don't like what it is that you've got to do, you send a message to the stomach not to break down that matter into energy, because if we get the energy, we'll have to do so and so. So there's a very intimate relationship between the activities in your stomach, the whole digestive process. Dige means break the earth up to release the energy. So that you can see what is meant really by Christ's statement, you've got to become innocent like that child. Because that child really believed and looked in its own mind, and it had no preconception. And it found in its mind that there were two things it didn't like. The first one was the lady with the harsh voice. And the other thing was, she had had to play an organized fun game with the other children, a thing she's never done in her life before. She's never had any organized anything. Organization to her meant restriction of her will. So she didn't want to play organized fun games, and she didn't like this harsh voiced lady in the next room. That's two very good reasons. So the message went down to the stomach and kicked out all the food which would have become the energy to take her into a situation she didn't want. The result was that it was decided to let her not go today so that she could observe that there was no tendency in her to become sick. So throughout the whole of today, she's just played about and had no trouble at all. And very badly said, today I'm all right. And I said, did you think about whether you liked things or didn't throughout the day? And she said, yes. And there were only the two things that I didn't like. And then she said, but today is Thursday, and then there's Friday, and then there's Saturday and Sunday, before Monday comes. And two of those days which I am not going to go to school are Saturday and Sunday, and they're not holidays, those are mine in any case. So she said, I'm really most pleased about Thursday and Friday not going. So you can see, fundamentally, the will is adding things up all the time. Now we tend to think that the intellectual side of our being is separate from the volitional side, and it is not, because the tel in intellect, in intelligence, is the Greek telos, purpose. It means simply will. driving along to a definite purpose, which means that there is no intellect other than the will to formulate. It means there is no reason other than the will to explain itself. Now, modern psychologists are not quite clear about this. They think that a man can reason independently of his volitional bias. A heresy that the Marxists are aware of when they say that a man cannot will to be truly logical, he can only will to rationalize his will's intention. And the thing, therefore, if you wish to become really logical, is to will to conform to the ruling principle of the universe, which is logical because only logic is efficient. Now, you know, there are two big groups within the Roman Church of Dominicans and Franciscans. Thomas Aquinas was a Dominican. And in order to keep control of people, you have to postulate that reason is prior to will. You have to say that the universe is inherently reasonable and that we will never get away with willful behavior because the universe is reasonable and we must be destroyed if we are unreasonable within a reasonable universe. So Aquinas, lifting out this concept partially from Aristotle, and in order to bolster up the authority of the church in matters of truth, which is the same as form, which is presented rationally, the ratio of form to form, he said, therefore, that in God reason is superior to will. And therefore every will have to become reasonable. But the Franciscans don't believe in the dom, in Dominicans. They don't like the limitation. They don't like the bondage. The Franciscans, Francis means free. So they said the will of God is prior to his intellect, because whatever there is of reason in the divine is only so because God wills to be reasonable. He isn't inherently reasonable. He is essential will, willing to be reasonable because it's more efficient. And if ever it becomes efficient to behave in another way, that would be spontaneously an expression of his will to the good. And it would always be a rationalization of his will. If, therefore, when we look inside ourselves, instead of wasting time looking for what we would call our reason for doing something, if we look for our motive, the state of our will, and ask ourselves a very simple pair of questions. Are we willing to destroy at the moment, or are we willing to build? Are we willing to be enemies with this person or friends with this person? Are we willing to set fire to the place or to throw water on it, and so on? It's a very simple opposition in the will. Either the will is willing to cooperate, to be harmonious, to build, or it is willing to oppose, to refuse to cooperate, and to destroy. And if we turn to the will, we are turning to the cause, because the concept of cause, that encounters us to strike, is no more than a force applied, and all force is fundamentally, from the point of view of initiation of action, will. Therefore, Julius Caesar is made by Shakespeare to say, the cause is in my will. So if we want to examine the causes of events, we should not examine the reasons other than the volitional reasons I am building or I am destroying. So, an idea, as we see, is a rotation, and all these rotations are travelling round, and therefore an idea is continuously changing its significance as we talk about an idea. You notice in the language we talk about ideas. If we were to talk of an idea, of is the same as the word of, we would find a totally different kind of mental process. Talking about is ab and out. It's away from. So if I wanted to talk about football, then I would say football, yes, football. It's a game. That places me immediately to consider a certain class of activities called games, and to select one of them out called a ball game. And it isn't a game of cricket or golf or something. It's football we're talking about,
and they have a bladder with a very strong case outside so that when they kick it, it doesn't burst. Then I have to explain what a bladder is. So it's a thing that you fill with air and expand it, and the case outside is made of very, very strong leather. This is ab and out football. Ultimately, it's a question of a man who has, at the end of his legs, a certain structure called a foot, one on each, and that he applies energy through his limbs to this terminal point, and applies that terminal point to this blown-up bladder or something inside a leather container, and persists in driving it beyond other fellows with the same information, and attempting to get it between two sticks, all of which is ab and out football. Analyze it internally without destroying it, which is very, very difficult and requires a tremendous amount of energy. It requires energy because every idea is a force, and when you are thinking, you are trying to dislodge, disrupt forces which are bound together in a certain way. This is why thinking is difficult, because it involves you in energy expenditure when you analyze an idea, because it is made up of subsidiary ideas, each one of which is a center of force, which fundamentally is a will. And if you don't analyze it in such a way that it is pleased, it will oppose your analysis. Now, when we're talking about this universe in terms of volition, in terms of sentiency, intelligent substance, that's the old idea of what the Greeks call the hylozoist idea, where the hyle of the Greeks is the word that we translate matter, although incorrectly. The Saxon word is much better, stuff, because stuff does not imply matura, rotation. Just implies spatial occupancy in stuff. And the zoe root is, of course, life. So hylozoism means the stuff of the universe is alive. We can then consider that as a giant, single-celled being, internal to which there are some fluids and little particles, and the fluids are always rotating, and those rotations are the forms of the activity internal to that hylozoic universe. In which case we can then call the whole thing up there a universal soul. That is the anima mundi of the philosophers of the ancient world. The world soul is a living substance which is fundamentally will when we consider it as initiating the process. And as eternal, we call it spirit form. Spirit means energy formulating itself. So, we've seen here that this idea involves analysis of a prime activity, and that the whole process of the universe illustrated here shows us how the stars being formed in a certain place must send their radiations in curves through each other all the time. Now the ancients said very, very clearly, the sun sends out light, but it doesn't diminish because it is being fed. And the idea that light from this star is radiating and going round here, and this star is receiving some of it and also radiating, and they're all radiating across to each other, is what is meant by Gurdjieff in the reciprocal feeding. He just lifted the idea out of the sources of Indian metaphysics. The Japanese word for it is the same concept, mutual interpenetration of forces, jiji muge they call it, driving in of all beings into each other. It's the same thing that Plotinus and the Neoplatonists meant by compenetration, where every force leaving its center must necessarily traverse the whole sphere and enter all others. So that in our paralogic, the logic beyond Aristotelian logic, we say that every being is itself and simultaneously every other being. Because if you remember that B means rotate, and all the rotations are going round here, whatever rotation is there, the force is leaving it and going into another place. And therefore every point of the universal field, or the universal soul, contains motions from all of them. And therefore, every single point in the universe is identical with all the others, essentially.
And therefore the only difference between centres within the universe is stress on the particular kind of formal activity at the moment. So if there is a process of rotation down here about 5 o'clock and it moves to 6 o'clock, if we looked at this and call this the historic process, remember our numbers from last time, 12 and down, and there's the 6 or sex function, and it is developing and travelling up here to try to get self-government. The forces rotating there as they travel round, viewed from inside the system by one of them, appear to be history. That is, some of these motions are involved into it and called memory, and some of them it has not yet reached, which it calls the future. It is simply travelling round there inside the cosmic substance, the sentient substance, and appearing to itself to be travelling through what it calls time. Now the word time is the word emit, if you remember, and it is measured in terms of emissions of energy. And if we marked this off in degrees, we could say that when an energy leaves this point, we'll say 7 o'clock, and appears in point 8, that the emission of energy across there is what we mean by time, because the thing is first at 7 o'clock, then at 8 o'clock. It has therefore changed its place. And change of place takes what we call time, namely energy emission. Now, we were talking before about the movement towards the centre being a movement for the good boys or the sheep, and the movement towards the perimeter for the goats or naughty boys, who, if they manage to get out, will make universes of their own outside. And from this point of view, William Blake said that people on earth are worshipping the devil under the name of Jehovah, because Jehovah himself, actually, we shouldn't pronounce it with consonants, because he's a string of vowels or free motions, and nothing constrains him. And the devil is the integration principle, which brings us on to the centre. But what drives people, as far as they believe, is the pursuit of their own end, namely the five freedoms. They believe they are looking for freedom. But if they believe that if they ever become free, they will be happy, it is ignorance. Because to be free is to be outside there and have to make yourself a universe. And you'd have to make it exactly according to this plan, because there is no other. Once you are enclosed inside a sphere, as Blake said, let God go into a sphere and see how he goes on. Once you've got outside and you've got your own sphere to make, you'll have exactly the same problem that the Creator had, because every sentient sphere must set up inside himself a rotating system in order to control the subsidiary substances and forces within his own being, because they will not like to be controlled any more than we do, who are inside the cosmic self. So we could say then that whether we're moving towards the centre or to the perimeter depends on whether we have completed a cycle of evolution. We move towards the centre when we're looking for security and feel a certain amount of dependence on some source of information, or source of food. Information is a kind of food. And when we've got it, we want to turn away and make our own centres, just like children go to the parents for food and pocket money and so on. And when they've grown up big enough, they want to go right out and make a home of their own. Now, absolutely, the absolute expects you to do that ultimately. The thing is not to run away prematurely, because if you do, you'll never get out. The thing is to drive yourself into the centre until you understand enough about your own being to be able to turn away without wanting to come back. So, whether we go towards the centre or to the perimeter depends on our level of being and how far we've gone. It's nothing at all to do with moral issues. It has to do with what we have done and understood, and whether we're going in or out now is not important, because the whole process, in any case, is cycling. Now, the name of God, as given by Plato, is Kronos. And Kronos is translated Saturn. And Saturn is the devil. And he derives it from two words. I'll put them down here. You see, Koros itself, which you can see is the same as Kuros, to run. and that Yorkshire nouse, or noose. Put these two words together, and you get chronos, chronos. And that's Saturn, time. Because as long as this rotates, there is time. Because the rotation is no more than an emission of energy from one place to another. So the very same fellow that Plato is talking about and says he's God is the fellow that we, since the rise of Christianity, have been assured is the devil. And we are assured that it is a very wicked and devilish and immoral activity to collect substance, mammon. Now, the collecting tendency is towards the centre. And the organisations that collect are, in general, two, the state and the church. They're called the right and the left. The church is supposed to be the left. It's supposed to sing you a song about why you should deliberately circumscribe yourself and donate. And the state itself really is vested in the army, which is called the right arm of the state. And between the right and the left, there is stability. Between hitting somebody with your strong right arm or stroking them with your weak left arm, stability comes. And they are both justified. The New Testament is very clear about this. There are no powers on earth, no matter how bad, that are not established from above. We can see that above means towards the centre. We talk about going up to the metropolis, don't we? And a person, from the point of view of the intelligence in the centre, pushed outwards, is said to be flung out. He's ostracised. Kick him out. He's no good for this society. So that we have two motions, a centripetal motion there and a centrifugal motion there. And those two motions are dependent entirely on the level of your understanding of yourself, which means how much you are aware of the rotation of forces, forces which are ideation or thinking, when you try to clarify them. And when you get to a certain level, you understand what that centre is about, then you are free to move along, go to the perimeter, go out if you like, and force your way in again if you like. But before you can do that, you have to have complete integration of your own being. You will never be allowed out until you have complete self-control, because you cannot get through this rotation band unless you have a terrific amount of energy, and that you cannot get unless you unify yourself. The same principle that allows an amoeba to split, a monocell to become two, and so on, is simply that the energies inside have reached a certain point where they can integrate on new centres. And when the integration power of the forces within it reaches a certain level, there are really two centres coming to be in that substance, and the two centres ratify their dual natures by splitting into two bodies. And there again it is a question of might is right. Can you do it? Might means the belly power, and right is your ruling power. If you have the prime will and you drive it up and formulate it, then you are right. And if you don't, then you will not have the might either. Because it requires terrific energy to mobilize the will in an efficient way, which is the same thing as a logical way, fundamentally. And therefore, in a true idea, you have evidence of colossal amounts of work done by some beings and handed to you through your hereditament. So at the point where you can begin to think clearly, and turn back in this epistrophe of Plato, this back-turning of yourself, when you can do that, it is evidence that a few thousand years of effort has been made towards self-inhibition, self-control, and release from external control. Let's remember that outside this circle, we call it spirit as non-bound form, and ignoring it as form, washing away all forms absolutely and all considerations, we call it the absolute. Absolute means it is solved away, washed away. when all considerations are deliberately put aside, considerations, when we no longer sit things together, and we retain simply the feeling of the whole without the formal differences, we call it the absolute. If then we say of the absolute, by definition, it is not definable, which is paralogic again, because to define is to set the limits and the absolute has none, we define the absolute negatively by saying it is infinite, not finite. But when we come to consider that being infinite, we cannot deny it anything, we assert that coextensive with the infinity of the absolute, there is spirit, that is formal play of force. So that spirit means forces behaving in a formal manner. And they are coextensive with the absolute. And that same spirit it is which has, as one of its forms, the spherical rotation, the biggest one of which, when we conceive it, we call God. And considering it as substantial, we call it God's body. Considering it as a rotating system with form order in it, we call it the Lord, L-O-R-D, where L equals labor, work. And Lord means the principle of order, working. So when we remember order is ord, rota, the rotation of forces, then the whole universe, as an orderly structure, willed intelligently, is called the Lord. So we call it the body of God as substantial. We call the same thing as an orderly progression of forces, intelligently determined, the Lord. We call it God as good when we aim at it as our object of will. You know, the atheists don't call God good. They say God isn't good because we're not aiming at it. Good is the thing at which your goal, or in the case of individual human beings, gullets, the little wills aim at. So we can then see quite clearly what the theologians are really talking about. Now, the word that we often use when we're dealing with science and views of the world to put forward a view, a guess, if you like, a conjecture, or an approach to understanding, when we have no evidence externally, is called a theory. And this theory means God differentiates. A theory is that which gives you the orderly pattern of events in your logic department, in your intellect. So that to theorize is to see things the way God sees them. This is the way the Greeks understood the word theoria. Theos is God. And as God runs, the way in which he runs, that is called theoria, theory. Then there comes, out of the theory and after it, practice, which is pira actis, or the rational activity derived from a consideration of theoria. Now this is God, and the whole process, speak to me Thora, is the theoria, or running of God. And to understand that running process of force inside this cosmic body is to understand the theory of the universe. Now this word theory is frequently abused at lower levels in science, but at the top levels of really good thinkers like A.N. Whitehead, is aware that theory historically derives from this Greek concept that the way God runs, it's theos, God, and rhea, to run. You see, the way God runs round is theoria. You see, it's theory. It's God running round. And if you understand that God is force, intelligent force, the way that he runs round is the formal statement about the universe as form. And practice is pira actis, and the K in the act. We must be very careful about this. We've got this. I'll put an S in there to remind you that's gone. And that's theory. And we put a little A on the end of that, and let that Y be an I, and that's degree. The way God runs is theory. And when somebody says that's all right in theory but no good in practice, they're talking about a bad theory, a false theory. Because a good theory is one that just makes practice possible and makes it accurate. So if we understand the way God runs round, this is the way he runs round, he just does this all the time. That's theory. If we study the geometry of all the formal relations of that process, we're leaving an exhausted bit in the middle there, the centre, from which there emerges continuously force going away. And it goes back in again, all the way around. That is theory. That's what it means. Now, phira actis is phi. Phira is the basis of the pi ratio. And if we turn this I into a Y, we see the word fire, fire. Because there is no reason, as we said before, other than the will behaving formally in a certain way. So the phira and the act, I'll put a K there, there's the letter C, anciently. Without that apply, I'll put that in. Phira actis. This termination at the end is simply the issue of it. The act implies closure. Akkut. You close your gullet to do it. And phira is your reason, which is your desire, your fire, formulating itself in order to act. And the fact that that K is in there means you are not looking at the theory, because the theory is the whole. Remember on this diagram we said that this is continuously whizzing round, so that every idea is becoming every other idea all the time. This is why it is so difficult to control an argument. My people talking about politics finish up about something totally different, because of the inherency of ideas, which is always to become other. So in phira actis we are taking a closed portion, a little bit of the theory, and allowing ourselves to apply ourselves to a partial. The theory of the whole is the theory. If we talk about the theory as a whole, the Sanskrit word for it is purna. This termination na means a serpent. Pur is the same as this. If we put this letter in Greek, it looks like that, something like our U. But it's pronounced midway between U and Y, as in U. So, in the word for stuff in Greek, if we learnt it like that in English, that Y in the middle, which would anglicise and say hana, in Greek it is hyle. And this sound, E-U, together, U, which occurs in German and also in French, is a sort of primitive sounding thing, U. It implies drive and precision simultaneously, because the vowel E means precision and the vowel U means drive. So the sound U means precision and drive. And if you say that, put your tongue in the position of E, hold it there and then round the lips without letting the tongue fall down and say U. And you then feel somehow cheeky. If you do it, you'll feel that. Just do it, make quite sure. But don't say ooh, just no. Say E, feel where your tongue is, it's right up against the palate. Now keep it up there and then round your lips and say E. Then you say, you see you dropped your tongue. Say E, now keep your tongue there, E. Keep your mind on your tongue so that it doesn't fall. E, and then round your lips. E. Now you're making a difference. Now you see how hard it is to do this. In German it's easy. Everybody says U in German. They have two of these sounds, one with a U with an umlaut on it, 2 points, and then one with an O, the same. One is U, the other is U. They're both primitive sounds because the Germans are primitive people. And the French also have this U sound, and the Greeks had it. And it means precision and drive simultaneously. So in this Hüle, as stuff, it is really incorrect to translate it matter. So the philosophers say very calmly, there is no correct translation for the Greek hyle. There isn't. Because hyle is hyle. That's all there is to it. The word ghoul, the Arabic word ghoul, which is a blood-sucking spirit in the desert. Some people call it a ghoul. But really, ghoul is it's an aspirating sound. Is the same thing, because this spirit is the eater in the riddle of Samson. That becomes the meat. It is a hyle. And if you make that sound properly, you'll feel primitive and yet somehow clear, clearly primitive and primitively clear. So when we come to consider this pur now, here, this pur, if we take this word on its own and put an I there, pur, it's a French word meaning ban, isn't it? It's part of that root which means ban to the French. It's ban because the French are trying to be reasonable. They're not succeeding, they're trying. So when they don't quite make the grade, they say that's bad. But as far as the real meaning of that is concerned, it means a person or a point. And remember, every point is sentient and therefore it's truly a person. There's no such thing as non-personal matter, because every point of rotation is halozoic. It is a stuff of life. And it is a self. So this pur implies a pushing and a going along and a becoming different at the same time, pur. And na is the serpent. So purna means this whole process. When we take out a little tiny bit of it, we say p, because that vowel is short, precise, and the radial activities of it, radiation from it, and the closure of the k implies that we have selected arbitrarily a little tiny bit of theory, or the total way God behaves, and we then say that we have done this for a pirai vat purpose, don't we? For a private purpose. Now this is the route to go, va, there's our reason again, punctilious reason, and the te, function at the end, means crucified on feeding. So private is the same thing as being crucified on a particular ambition. So every person with a private purpose, by definition, is doomed to fail. And therefore we say they are privated when it's taken off them, the thing that they wanted to get. So if a man like Nuffield decides he'll corner a lot, a mammon, he comes to a point where he realises that he's looking at half a circle. He will have to give it back if he wishes to get the good opinion that he wanted when he decided ambitiously to get it in order to get good opinion. Because, of course, the only reason people chase it is in order to make other people think that they're great fellows. And when they've got it, they have to give it back. So you find all the great mammon worshippers of the world, the Henry Fords or the Rockefellers or others, they collect it to build themselves up, big opinion, and then they have to give it back to the people from whom they took it in order to get their good opinion. That's dialectic. It is the natural process of events, as we saw about an idea. It passes all the way around the circle and becomes its opposite. So, when we're talking about practice, we should be very, very careful, because the less we practice, the better. Because practice implies that we have taken a little portion of the theory and applied it in a particular situation, which is privated, that is to say, deprived of the rest of it. And when we get a statement like sufficient for the day is the evil thereof, it's a statement that in a given situation, when you are required to do something, you shouldn't fall down to the level of thinking that you are applying a theory in practice. You should allow the theory to apply itself through you, and then you become a vehicle of the theory. You know, a fellow, even a little fellow like Hitler, was aware that the German soul was, in its mythic sources, Norse, and had a terrible kind of conflict between the gods and the giants, in which the gods got the worst of it, which is very strange. In German mythology, the gods get a bashing. In the Luther Demerald, you have the Twilight of the Gods, where the gods are fighting these very tough fellows, and they don't win. And the reason is, Teuton, Teuton, is the same thing as the voice of God. And the Germans think they are gods. And every time they have a fight, the other fellows win. And this reflects itself in the mythology. And Hitler knew that. What he didn't realize was that it is necessarily so. He thought he could capitalize on this mythology and tell the Germans that they truly were gods, but this time they were going to beat the giants. Now, he was alert enough to see that this sphere and the travelling round it of the historic process is only the development of its internal actualities. And therefore, if you tell somebody there that they can get to there, the opposite, and then get in front of them there, they will think they are following you. Now, he actually had the nerve to say so. If you've read Mein Kampf, you'll remember that he says, I will break truces and tell lies whenever necessary, and also that I will get ahead of the people in the direction I know they are going, and then they'll think that they're following me, and then they'll call me der Führer. So, if you know that there is a cyclic process, and you believe that the other people don't know it, and you go ahead in the direction that they think they are going, and you keep saying, look, I'm ahead of you, then they'll get an idea that they're following you, and eventually they'll do as they're told by the man in front. What he didn't see was the inherent processes of self-refutation, because although he got a smattering of the true meaning of the theory, yet he had not liked it for his private purpose. Certain aspects of it he did not like, and he thought that because the universe is fundamentally volitional, as Schopenhauer had taught him, therefore he could somehow by will defeat the logic of the universe, because it's only a battle of wills, isn't it? After all, it's only God, and he's a very diffuse sort of being, and myself, well, I'm terribly compacted and very sure of myself. And if you think that God is a very large and diffuse and somewhat vague old gentleman, and you're really a very vital and compacted and clever human being, it arises in your mind that you can defeat his logic, when you know that it's only will, and that one of his names is Saturn, Kronos, Father Time, the Ancient of Days. He's represented with a long beard, and he can hardly stand up. Therefore, we can easily beat him. This is the kind of process that goes on in the mind when you think about it. If you sit down and meditate on this, can I get my own way as a finite individual inside a universe which is fundamentally volitional and is only being logical on purpose? Can I understand the logic in such a way that I can defeat it? Because I know it's only being willful, really. God is willing to be God. He's not essentially God. He's just willing to be God. And just because I happen to be born inside him, he's willing to make me behave. But if I can understand the principle that he knows, surely I can defeat him. Well, of course, it's bad reasoning, because if you understand the principle that he knows, the best you can get out of that game of chess is a stalemate. So, we have the whole process here, and this concept of privation, of being deprived of the whole of your understanding, by deliberately choosing a particular, should be considered very seriously. Because most people find that their occupations have been chosen for them by someone else. And very, very few people are quite satisfied with the position they have been given. If we take a middle-class family as an example, where a certain amount of social uplift has appeared in them, so that they want their children to have it better than they did, as they say, and they don't want the children to have to go and work like ordinary folk, so they work themselves very hard, send them to a university, and then they think, now what can we do with him? How bright is he? He doesn't understand mathematics or something, so he can't be a scientist. He doesn't understand anything much, you see. So after much thought, they'll push him in a given direction where his inherent weaknesses, as they see them, make it possible for them to push him, and they might finish up by saying, well, he's no good for science or politics, he can't go in the government, he can't understand anything. And in the end, perhaps he can't get through 6-year studies in the medical course and so on. The fellow's no good, so we'll let him go in the church. Now, that's a very common analysis, because you don't have to know, really, very, very much, know to go in that direction. And there's only one thing lower than that, and that is saying the fellow's no good at all, let him be an artist. And this is always a movement towards lifting the person up a bit, which exposes him to situations which he himself has not made with his own will. And therefore his will, which is one of these little twizzling things here, is continuously trying to make up its mind whether it ought to go to the centre and be good, as it says, and his own very universal rule, or whether it should run the other way and finish up in Adelaide House. The choice is there, and the choice is always, shall I go to the centre or to the perimeter? Am I going to obey cosmic law or disobey it? And all the laws that are established on Earth are established from above, that is, from the centre, because all form, as we see in this diagram, is continuously spinning out of the centre to the perimeter. So the centre is the source, the wellspring from which everything comes. Now, if we go towards that, deliberately, we're doing a very strange thing, because all the forces that are emerging from there are flinging us to the centre. But they're coming out of the centre. And they're flinging us to this perimeter here, and making a little centre on the perimeter for us, because they turn as they go, all these processes. It appears that the central force that orders us wants us to get into trouble, because all the trouble occurs on the perimeter. This means to say that the government of the world, the government of cosmos, is driving us out to our sense organs all the time, where we will get into trouble. This is why Christ, when he's asked to give a type of prayer, gives them the Lord's Prayer, and puts in the Lord's Prayer a very funny thing that a lot of ministers don't like, where you pray to God the Father, "Oh, lead us not into temptation," which makes God a kind of devil. But the point is, a lot of weak people who haven't had much experience say, if it is true that the universe is orderly and we cannot get away with willfulness, well then we're going to be clerks for the system. We're going to find out what the orders are and obey them. And if they manage to do that and go prematurely to the centre, they'll constitute a little bureaucratic wall round the centre, and they'll remain profoundly ignorant and keep passing the orders from centre over themselves to the other fellows on the outside who can't fill in the forms. And in order to make sure that those beings do not become static and fail to evolve, this force from the centre is continuously flinging people out to the perimeter into experience. And this is in experience that we discover that we don't know things. And this makes us more and more and more desire to know things in order to control ourselves, to release ourselves from the determination and dominion of forces outside ourselves that we don't like. So that if we could, like little babies, always have mummy and always stay little so that we could be nursed forever, we would do so. But because this central force is swinging out all the time, babies grow up. They can cry like mad, but their legs get longer every day. And ultimately they find they can pick a spoon up and shovel it in. They still want to go back where they were the first time. And mummy says, like Kierkegaard says, she has to paint the breast black so that we'll begin not to like it. Otherwise it will never go away. Because if we could get things laid on as it was in utero, in heaven, then we'd stay there. But the central force, the creative force of the universe, is continuously spinning us out into experience, which is the same as time play or temptation. And it is God, the creator, who is flinging us into the time, and yet time is Saturn, Chronos, the devil. So it is God who is throwing us into temporal experience, which is the zone of temptation. But the whole process is so that we shall leave nothing undone, and ultimately shall have full understanding of our own possibilities, and then we will be fit for freedom. Free dome. To be able freely to dome ourselves, to rule ourselves.
So well, why do we pray in that state not to be led into it, if we see at the moment the benefit of it?
Well, it's a matter of logic, you see. Supposing you said, lead me into temptation, you'd be talking about a bias in yourself, wouldn't you?
Mm.
Now, unless we can get an opposition, we cannot grow. Unless we get a force acting like this, supposing there's the earth, that's matter, that's blocked. If we lay two sticks and press them very hard, they'll stand up like that, won't they? So the elevation of a being depends on forces in opposition. So we have to pray against our inclination to get the opposition. So if we were already wanting to go into temptation, and we said to God, please lead us into temptation, when we're already going, we're saying, don't oppose us. But it's only through the opposition that we can elevate ourselves. So if we tend not to go into temptation, we want pushing, really. Because we've already been hurt, we don't want to have any more to do with it. On the other hand, if we are liking it, we need opposing. So you don't lead us into temptation, we're already going that way. You see? Push us the other way. We want the opposition. Like Blake says, opposition is through friendship. This question of opposition must be understood very carefully, because if it is, you will move in a totally different way from your ordinary way of moving, because you will always look for opposition. Not stupidly, but you will look for the kind of opposition that you are strong enough to put up with for the time being. And as that opposition comes and you overcome it, you are then stronger and you can deal with the next opposition. But you will begin to look for opposition, because you cannot grow without it. Just like a little boy, as soon as he can stand up, he'll start trying to lift up a stone. It's too heavy for him. And if he doesn't try to lift something slightly too heavy, well, then he won't lift something heavier later. When he feels the pain in his muscles, he doesn't stop. The drive is in him. He can conquer it. Will, it's got to come up. And it's this determination in the individual, which looks like individual will, which is the cause of the evolution and the integration of that same individual will later.